G'day and welcome back to Talking Leadership TV. Our guest today is Anise Haddad, a global nomad and executive coach who has spent over 15 years coaching leaders of multinational companies across various industries. He's a certified transformational leadership facilitator and professional certified coach with a coaching philosophy that centers around the belief that change, transformation, and reinvention gives individuals the opportunities to grow and expand the definition of who they are. Anise is passionate about mindful leadership, resilience leadership, culture change, personal transformation, self-improvement, and team performance. I know you'll enjoy today's podcast, which focuses on challenges to leaders and entrepreneurs. But as always, enough from me. I'll hand over to Anise.
Let's look at the topic area of challenges to leaders and entrepreneurs. And before we kick off, just for the sake of continuity of the conversation, I don't care whether you lean to one or the other or you reference both, because I'm interested in both. And so I'll leave that to you as we have the discussion. But I want to put something to you and challenge any part of this, that there is a need for leaders and entrepreneurs to continually engage with what are increasingly volatile markets and business environments. I strongly believe that. And as a starting point for what we're going to talk about today, what would you classify, if you could give me a list of three? I mean, the list could be longer, but for the purposes of some conversation here, your three biggest challenges facing leaders or entrepreneurs pre-COVID?
Oh my, pre-COVID, three biggest. That seems like such a lifetime ago. It's hard to remember. I think pre-COVID, a lot of the stuff we saw was pretty generic. Retention, efficiency, having their teams be more proactive and be more engaged with each other, breaking down the silos, stuff like that. Those are areas. Trust has been an area for a long time that people have been working on. Taking ownership has been around for a long time. So I think these are the general areas that we've been writing books on for the last 20, 30, 40 years, which were all in place pre-COVID.
Okay, so that being the case, do you think in a post-COVID world that list would change for you? Did COVID throw up challenges to leaders and entrepreneurs that had flown under the radar, or did it magnify things that already existed?
Yeah, it certainly magnified a lot of stuff that already existed. Things like trust become even more crucial post-COVID. Ownership, pre-COVID, the sense of ownership is taking responsibility, that I don't blame others, I get it done, I don't become a victim. I mean, looking at external sources that are bothering me, things like that, all that is pre-COVID. Post-COVID, there's a new area, and it's hard to find a word for it, that I've noticed at all the C-suite teams I've worked with. There's a desire for each member of the team to not only own functionally what is in their remit, but also have the same sense of ownership over the whole organization. So this sense of collective ownership or total ownership, the wording isn't clear enough yet, because I don't think a whole lot has been written about this. Collective ownership waters it down, because it's like, okay, well, if I screw up, my buddy over there who's got the other, he's going to take it. It's not that. It's each person taking really total. It's like, if we're going to succeed, I got to own this whole thing in addition to the function that I manage. And that's, I've done many workshops now in that space, and it's quite a transformative way of looking at things, and it changes even remuneration plans, how bonuses get calculated. We've always had a portion of bonus that's on the group results and then a large portion that's on individual results, and that's all being tweaked and changed now to to kind of illustrate, to kind of react to change. And a lot of it was because COVID was so complicated. It really made everybody realize that when things are difficult, no single person has the answers. Nobody knows what to do. So if we as a group can get together and 1 + 1 is equal to 3 or 4 rather than half, then we can move forward. So the old way of doing stuff, very hierarchical, 1 + 1 + 1 is probably 2. So we lose stuff because there's all these interactions and stuff. Now we want more. We want it to work together better. I don't even
Sure.
have the word for that because it's kind of
No.
hard to.
Oh, 100% agree. I haven't heard it put that way, that idea of total ownership of the space that you work in. And I think, and it's an interesting concept, and as it plays out, I'm going to follow what that will mean, because I think there's a clash in my mind around some people going to work wherever work is, or whatever work looks like, and it's quite a functional thing for some people. They go in, clock on, they give their mind to the place for the 7.5, 8 hours, then they clock off, and there is no more connection to the business outside of that, because multiple reasons, you're there to make money, or you have no stake in the place. And so if there's no financial stake, am I assuming that total ownership perspective is an emotional or cultural connection to the place? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, if you take it into a personal relationship area, it's like a husband and wife, a couple. If you ask them, what's your level of ownership of the success of this marriage, and it's 50-50, then you've got a problem. But if each person is 100% committed to that and emotionally committed and all that, then it succeeds. So it's not 50-50. There is that, it's 100%. So in our old way of doing things in an enterprise level, you have this function, marketing, sales, there's production, there's engineering, there's R&D, and you're responsible for that. You don't have much responsibility for the overall. That's the CEO's role, the CFO, they kind of have that role. And what's changing now is through this complexity, we're learning that the top team needs to also have that view. The CTO needs to have a point of view on stuff that are financial. The marketing person, a point of view on something related to HR. So that's the kind of change. The examples that I use, you can kind of get this through a typical executive committee meeting often looks like a wagon wheel with the CEO speaking to this person. That person presents something, the numbers for next month or whatever, and they interact with the CEO, and then it's the next person. They talk about their thing, they interact with the CEO. There's feedback, questions and answers. Every once in a while, somebody else will ask a question, but it's usually that. It's a wagon wheel with the CEO in the middle. And what we're moving toward is the CEO removing himself or herself from that hub, and there's much more interaction between people on all the topics. Because that's what came out during COVID. You had to have these conversations because it was so complex that it didn't work otherwise. And that's proving to be, I believe, a new way of operating going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting, brave new world in a post-COVID world. And from what I'm seeing in my travels through my professional circles, that the primacy of your team and their welfare, and that they're committed to the place, is a lot more in the forefront of people's thinking, rather than putting the profit motive, although that's still a driver, that you won't make a profit if your team is not functional. There's always that connection. And one thing I'm curious to ask you about, again, I don't want an example of a business, I don't want to be singling anyone out here, but I get the sense that people in leadership or entrepreneurial roles that said our people really matter got caught out during COVID and post-COVID, or the ones that would say that as window dressing and didn't actually really believe it, it came to bite them on the backside because the complexity of what COVID threw up around how you work, where you work, the hours that you work, your ability to be remote and mobile when needed, or then coming back to a world of work where the bosses wanted you to be in the office more for whatever reason, that there doesn't seem to be logical rhyme or reason to it, that it's exposed very poor and uncritical thinking and potentially a lack of empathy towards your greatest asset, which is your people. And I love the word complexity because it denotes that when you're dealing with human beings, it's never going to be black and white. We work in shades of gray in lots of what we do, and you spot that quite tellingly. So from your experiences, and this might be a hard one to ask this early on into the discussion, but I'll throw it out there and see what you think. Do you believe leaders learnt something from the pandemic about the management of other human beings to help them meet these challenges going forward?
Yeah, that's a
Without
big
without
one.
naming a
Yeah.
leader, without naming a particular leader,
Oh.
I don't want you to go there, but just in broad terms.
I think generally, I'm a positive person, an optimistic person generally. And I would say that for the most part, the vast majority of us in business and in the world that I function in certainly did learn a lot through that process and are certainly paying more attention to all of that. It's messy, so that doesn't mean that all of a sudden everybody is rosy and everything,
Yeah,
and
sure.
we're all singing Kumbaya that around a campfire. But generally, there's a much deeper awareness and acceptance of the need for well-being. It's like the whole thing about a few years ago, it was heroic for CEOs or top executives to only get 3 4 hours a night of sleep. It's like, yeah, I don't need to sleep much. I get a lot of work done. I'm not going to waste my life sleeping. And then you hear stories here in Singapore. There was a CEO who of a large multinational, the Asia Pacific branch of a large multinational, who was quite young and very, very fit, go to the gym all the time, running and everything, and simply died. And the best explanation that's been put forward was his habit of only sleeping 3 4 hours a night and being very proud of it. I see a lot less of that. I see much more awareness of the need for well-being. Certainly compared to 20 years ago when I was running my company in France, it's a whole different world from that.
I don't think there are too many CEOs walking around wanting to hang their head on a 3 or 4 hour nightly sleep pattern, because I think we're all very aware that you need good sleep or restful sleep to do what it is that you need to do. That doesn't mean we don't have our type A personalities that are extremely driven and will do what they need to do to succeed. And I don't begrudge them that. The impacts down the track, and there's enough literature on this that I don't think I'm talking out of school, that leading to drug dependencies or alcohol abuse or poor relationships, a lot of this stems from not having a balance. But in an idiot like me saying that, what is a good balance? I had a lot of years where I put thinking about work ahead of other things, including thinking about a young family, and I feel shame about that. But I think a lot of leaders or those aspiring to leadership roles tend to want to push themselves to prove a point. And at some points in my own career, I don't know if I was trying to prove something to me, someone to some something to somebody else, or some mix of those two things. And ambition's a real kick in the guts because it leads to very poor decision making. Now, speed the dial through COVID. I agree with you that nobody got it exactly right. And yeah, I was being facetious before. I would say 90% of leaders are probably doing the right thing. There will be a percentage of those in the leadership and entrepreneur space that are the classic sociopaths or narcissists that would have got caught out through that process because the need for overt empathy and understanding the plight of others is not a skill in high regard amongst those in that narcissistic sociopathic framework. And again, small cohort of the leadership entrepreneurial space, but those people exist. And what fascinates me beyond all that is the cultures in which we worked in. Now, did they change or did they adapt to the circumstances? And are we going back to old habits? And and like you, I think I'm a LinkedIn tragic. You watch what's happening on LinkedIn. I'm not sure whether we've gone full circle and we've sort of left the worst of things behind back to an old way of doing things. But the fascination for me is there's a whole group of employees now that aren't going to take the old ways of doing things very well, and turnover is going to be an ongoing issue for companies of all sizes, whether you're in the profit or not for profit space. So what's your views there, Anise?
So my views are not academic, and I don't do research. So the views are a very small keyhole into the companies, the teams that I've worked with. The main thing that I run into is people. So pretty much everybody that I work with is in their 40s and 50s. That's kind of the C-suite space, midlife. And the challenges that I encounter the most frequently are people adjusting to the fact that the way they were working before is no longer sustainable. So I write about, in the book that's coming out in February, I write about three winds of midlife change. One of them is physiological, which we're kind of talking about right now with sleep and stuff. These 20, 30-year-olds who really push hard and don't sleep, I know a number of them. They wake up 7 a.m. and they're working until 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. or midnight. And they sleep for a few hours, get back up and start again. I know them in some of the consulting organizations and stuff. It's okay in the 20s and 30s. They can make it work. Then in the 40s come along and hit, and boom, that catches up with them. And their prefrontal, so the second wind of change is neurological. The prefrontal cortex is getting slower, as I'm sure you know. We forget our keys, we forget where we put our iPhone. We forget numbers in a spreadsheet, whereas when we were in our 20s and 30s and we're presenting to the board, we know every one of the numbers and we can go into detail on it, we can deep dive on it, and we can spew it all out very accurately. And then that starts to diminish and slow down. And if we're struggling, but at the same time, we've got our hemispheres, the right and left hemispheres are connecting in more effective ways. And that's creating the ability to see patterns and connect the dots, which we couldn't do as well younger. The big issue, and third one, is parental. Our kids are growing up, and so the energy that we bring, the type of KPI-driven parenting that we did when they're younger, and which you automatically did with people at work, is no longer working, and we need to adapt to it. The big problem that I keep running into is people that are still holding on to that old way, because that's what worked for them. That became their identity, it became their sense of value. If you're an Indian, if you competed with hundreds and thousands of people to get to where you are now, and what worked for you to get there is not going to work anymore, that's very scary. And so that's the kind of shift that I see. And then when you put into that changes in generations, younger workers that want to be able to work from home, they want the flexibility, they want the sense of purpose. They don't want to just clock in, clock out. They want the company to represent something. And when you're going through those other changes, and this change comes too, it's a perfect storm of change that hits people in their 40s, in 40s, mainly in their 40s. That's the area that I see the most and that I find the most fascinating and intriguing.
The change in how we think. So you mentioned there that physiologically our brains are more attuned to pattern recognition and higher order thinking as we get older. Is that generally what happens? Can you have younger leaders and entrepreneurs where that's triggered earlier in their development in their 20s? And okay, so that happens. And why I ask this is your people like your Mark Zuckerbergs, your Richard Bransons, you look at those guys now and they're in their 40s and 50s or possibly older, but that didn't come from nowhere. So I don't think it was an overnight thing. And I preface all of this by saying I think intuitively the thinking of an entrepreneur is hardwired different to the thinking of a leader that's not in an entrepreneurial space. I don't mean that one is better than the other. I think it's different ways of looking at the same business world. And it fascinates me that you talk about how our brains develop over time. Because if you've had kids or you've looked after children and you watch them grow up, you watch that change in infantile thinking. And I'm trying to put this into categories as they progress to teenage years where the raging hormones kick in and the thinking goes a little bit all over the place, and then they're older teenagers, pre-20s, that something changes again. And as a dad, you love your kids and you don't care what they're like as they're going through these changes because you went through the same things, but you can see their thinking matures over that time. And it's fascinating to watch. You don't always agree with the decisions that come from that thinking, but you can see it in action. And I, to my lasting not credit, I haven't looked for that in the workplaces that I've been, but when I've had a chance to think about going back and think about the people that I've worked with over a period of time, even in small bursts of time, you can see people's thinking change. If you're working on projects, you see that in action, and it's quite an amazing thing to see. Whether or not it's effective is another question, but you see it happening, and it's quite amazing, and you touch on it. So why is that important to you?
Because so there are two angles to what you just shared. The one of them is that same shift that you saw in your kids and you see in the teenage hormones and the brain goes off and all that, and then something changes. And when you start to notice and read about the neurological shifts that happen at midlife, and then you start seeing it in the people around you that you're coaching, that you're working with, if they are aware of that change, it's much easier for them to harness it and lean in with it. So the same changes that you saw, that you mentioned in kids growing up, when I'm coaching people, I have them begin to notice how their own parenting style changed as well in response to those changes. We don't often think about that. We just do it because we love our kids, like you said. But it's changing us as well. It's creating more empathy. It's adapting our style with them. And what I'm really fascinated by is how we automatically take that into the workplace. So leaders of younger kids will have a workplace style that's very KPI driven. You do this, you get that. You miss that thing, then here's how you're going to be punished. It all very much sounds like raising young teens. Board members tend to have adult children, and they don't act like that. They don't respond generally. So I find it fascinating that there's a direct parallel there. I've often coached people who will, they've got kids that have just gone out of teenage years. And they've adapted their parenting style to them, but they're still talking about their team, saying, why can't they just grow up? And then they realize what they're saying, and they see that that's just lagging, and all they need to do is bring that energy that has come automatically at home and just apply that same energy there. People that don't have kids, becoming aware of that, it helps them to see how flexible we are. And then there's a choice. Let me not baby my team. They're all adults in the company. When I look around, there are no child laborers working around me. So these are all adults. So it's important for that perspective. Which goes back a bit to what you were saying earlier. The reactions to working from home, like people saying, I want everybody back in the office, that's teenage management. It's like, I can't trust you when I don't see you. So give me your keyboard and your mobile phone at night so that you're not up until 3 a.m. playing games. I'm going to keep it in the bedroom. So I need to have my, that's teenage parenting. We need to be leading our people as adults, not as teenagers.
The point you bring up there, the trust issue or the ability to metaphorically cut the umbilical cord and let the kids fend for themselves and do for themselves, the analogy in the workplace being how you've got to trust your people, that's very dependent on how I don't know if this is the right term, how self-actualized the leader is to have the courage and or the experience to say, yeah, I've got the right people around me that have got expertise. I just need to let them run free and do what they need to do, and I know that I'll get a result. And that presupposes that you have a trust in the people around you, and you've built that culture or at least facade of trust with your employees. I think for some it's very difficult, and for others it's not quite so difficult. What I will ask here then is, from your experiences, Anise, what tips or tools would you give to someone either watching or listening to this podcast to deal with a leadership challenge that might be thrown their way? From those three areas that you're interested in, give me a strategy that would work. For example, you're having an issue with your team and you want to get some kind of knowledge across to your team. How can you deal with that so you get over that hump so that you can get that information out without necessarily creating a barrier for yourself? What would you advise we could do?
How to boil it down into something that it's going to sound almost like motherhood statements. I think mostly people know how. My take is that people know how to, they don't need to be told how to do anything. My role as a coach is to help them see that they have the wisdom to do that. Much of it, especially since we're talking about people in at midlife, they've gone through stuff. I will link it back to difficult things that they've had to achieve in their personal relationships, because that's always very visceral, and there's love involved. There's tremendous commitment to making things work. It's not a theoretical conversation. It's not a hypothetical conversation. It's, what did you do with your son when he was going through those issues that he had when he was 17? How did you deal with that? What worked? What didn't work? Well, what didn't work was that I tried to really be hard on him, like I did when he was younger. That didn't work. So what did you finally do? Well, I asked him something, and whatever they were doing there is something that can be done outside. Who was it? The writer. It'll come back to me later. This is prefrontal cortex stuff slowing down. I can't remember the writer who said this. Humility and iron will, being a level six leader. It's the top type of leadership. And whoever said that, God, I can't even remember. Humility and iron will, the kinds of leaders that have that mix, both of humility and iron will, are phenomenal leaders. Up until recently, there was a sense that that was not something that you could develop. You're kind of, it's kind of innate, humility and iron will. I believe that's off. I believe that's because most of our leadership literature was coming out of research over the last 20, 30 years. And I don't think we've sufficiently delved into midlife as a transition period and looking at it the way we looked at teenagers. And we back in 100 years ago, we discovered that teenagers was a phase, and there are really these things that are happening. There's something similar going on with midlife. And I'm convinced that the perfect storm of midlife creates a wonderful opportunity for humility and iron will to come together. That's a long way to get back to your question. I would encourage people to really lean in. They've already got the iron will. That's how they got to where they're at. How can you develop humility? And not humility instead of iron will. Humility with the same iron will. You don't bring your iron will and your determination down. You keep it high, but you raise your humility, your vulnerability, and bringing those in, you'll solve the problems.
Yeah, when you mention vulnerability and humility, you're talking about maybe I can put this in a different way. You're humanizing yourself to the people that you work with, and that you're capable of making mistakes, identifying that you've made mistakes and that you can learn from them. But when they're other people's mistakes, you look at them as opportunities to learn and to grow your people, rather than it being a necessarily a negative thing. I think we can all get behind the iron will part of it. We all can be committed to something. We've all got a passion project. We all have something that we've got, that bit. And typically, I think we can tick those off. But that humility question, being able to make yourself vulnerable to colleagues, or subordinates, is there some risk there? And I understand why people are reluctant to do it, but as soon as you do it and people realize you're just as human as them, the respect changes a little bit, in like, oh well, the person I'm dealing with is not, doesn't think they're above the fray. They're just as vulnerable as we are. They just happen to have a title. And that can be a game changer in some settings. I've experienced it with other leaders that I've worked for, that you think there's been a light bulb moment and they've gotten just better over time because they've moved into that idea of being strongly committed to a thing or multiple things. But they're also approachable. They also stuff up and they wear their mistakes, and they're quite happy to tell you, yeah, I stuffed up, but I owned it. And they expect the same from you. And that's quite a challenge in the come up as a young person. And I encourage people to do that with young leaders, that put that challenge in front of them. But if they haven't gone through it or mentored someone through it, show them what you've done and give them a template. It doesn't mean do as I do, but it's like you'd be saying a mentoring coaching role where, hey, have a crack, learn from it yourself. Because I think our human inclination to do for others, to help them over a hump, stops us from letting them learn. And I'm speaking as a parent here, that you try and stop all bad things happening to your kids, but if they don't get to experience some bad things and learn from it and get stronger and more resilient, you're not doing them any favors as they get older, is what I've seen. That's a personal view, Anise. Can agree with everything that you've said there. The one question I've got though is, in a world where results also matter, so getting your goals achieved, what's a tip to try and help leaders or entrepreneurs get to those goals, and make that pathway a little less gray and a little more black and white, so you can see the finish line? What's your view there?
For me, that's all related. Let me share a story. There's a CEO of a textile factory in India that was dealing with fatalities. They had too many incidents, and they had had a few fatalities. I was coaching the CEO, and they had gone through a long period of having global consulting firms come in and set up dashboards and systems and everything to take care of accidents. Safety is job number one, banners everywhere and stuff, but they still have fatalities. So coaching the CEO, I asked him, what's your commitment? How would you rate your commitment to safety from 1 to 10? And he said, very high, probably a 9. And then the conversation started turning around. Maybe because it's a 9 and not a full 10, you're sensing something to not say 10. You're saying 9, so there's something is missing, and maybe that's why people are dying. And then he lost his temper with me. He said, I can't be on everybody's back. I've got 2,000 people. Most of them are uneducated. They do stupid things. Somebody at one end of the shop floor wants to get to the other end. A forklift comes by. He'll jump onto the front of the forklift. He knows he's not supposed to do that, and he rides at the front. I can't be on everyone's back. So his definition of 10 out of 10 commitment to safety was that, which is unachievable. But as he started thinking about it, it started bubbling in his mind, like, why did I say 9 out of 10? What is missing in my commitment? That's iron will that's pushing that. And humility to say something is off and maybe I'm responsible. Maybe there's something in me that's creating this. And his breakthrough was a wonderful story he shared with me. He was really excited on one of the coaching sessions. He said, I found my 10. He says, the other day I was on the shop floor and an elderly janitor slipped and twisted his leg, his ankle. I stopped to help him because I was walking by. I took my jacket off, put it under his head. I called for the safety people to come down, the nurse and everything. And he said, up to then, that's a 9 out of 10. That's what I would have always done. But I kept thinking, what's 10 out of 10? What does it mean, my 10 out of 10 commitment? So once the health people said the guy was okay, he just needs to go home and rest and don't walk for a few days. The CEO said, I decided to get him in my car and I drove him home. And then I helped him out to his house. I got him into his house. I spoke to his wife to make sure that she would make sure that he stays in bed for a couple of days. Don't walk on the. I had tea with them. And that was his transformation. That was the extra level, the extra step. And people talk about it. I mean, this is India. So, hey, the CEO took the janitor in his car, drove him home. And that sets the tone for 10 out of 10 commitment. So that became a motto, 10 out of 10 commitment. And everybody has to find what does that mean to them? It's not a guidebook that says this is what you do. This is 10 out of 10 commitment. You have to find what is it? What does 10 out of 10 commitment mean to you? That's the iron will and humility together. Jim Collins, that's who I was trying to think of. He writes about humility and iron will.
Oh, there you go. I thought you would get there. Look, Anise, this has been an amazing conversation. And pre us recording, I was thinking, what is the theme that's going to come out here in that midlife discussion around leaders and entrepreneurs and their thinking is quite a valuable conversation to have. And if you'll indulge me, I think we need to make some more time down the track to keep talking about this. Maybe post your book coming out, we can have a chat. I'd love to gauge what some of the feedback is from people once the book is released. And yeah, I'll get my own copy of it and have a read and maybe give you some feedback offline and ask you some questions and so on. So look, mate,
Wonderful.
I do appreciate this. I know you're busy and thank you for your time, mate.
Thank you, Eric. Wonderful being with you.
That concludes today's podcast. I'd like to thank Anise for his time and insights, and in particular, the perspective on leadership as we age. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great day, rest of your week, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Talking Leadership TV.